I'm Christopher Leiden for Open Source with Akhil Sharma at the leading edge of fiction writing today. There's a voice and a man here that I find mesmerizing, instructive, dear. We're talking about 3 years' worth of his New Yorker stories that all grow out of the shattered boyhood that he detailed in his novelized memoir, Family Life. It was all about Indian strivers in Queens in the dazed 30-year aftermath of a horrific accident. Watching and coping refined Akhil Sharma's eye for lonely people in lonely places, liars, lovers, cheats among them, in dark places, cut through with blazing laugh lines too. In his stories, there's a wider canvas of Indian men and women in import-export businesses and creaky arranged marriages. Sexual obsession feels like the thematic symptom of some nameless distress, though there is pleasure in these stories, and certainly in Akhil Sharma's presence. In my house in Boston, he's giving a taste from one of 8 stories, it's called The Well, in a collection titled A Life of Adventure and Delight.
In those days, I was always falling in love. I fell in love with Mrs. Muir from The Ghost of Mrs. Muir, with Mary Jane, Spider-Man's girlfriend, with Wonder Woman. I love the last two especially. I would imagine going for drives with Linda Carter or for walks in a park. I imagined us sitting on a sofa and holding hands. The fact that I could not drive and Wonder Woman would have to drive for us embarrassed me. It made obvious the difference in our ages. I felt that the proper relationship for me was with Mary Jane, who was younger and a cartoon, although I liked Linda Carter more. Years passed. We moved from Queens to New York, moves from Queens to New Jersey. I was 13, and the town we moved to had a lot of construction going on. When a house was nearly done, it would stand with landscaping around it, but one could see through the front windows into the backyard. If on my father's evening walks he came to a house with a new lawn that had freshly laid rectangles of turf, he would hurry home, get into his car, and drive back to the house. He would crawl over the lawn, peeling sections of turf from the yard. He would carry these into the back of his car and bring them home to our lawn, which was yellow and sunburned with rectangular patches of bright green. One summer evening, I was sitting at my desk in my room upstairs when I heard my father's car. In the back were the sheets of turf. My mother came running out of the house and stood by the driver's side door. "If you're going to steal, don't steal during the day," she screamed. "Do you know nothing?" "Grass doesn't belong to anyone," my father said, getting out of the car. "Grass is like air." Not looking at her, he walked to the trunk. "Do people pay to put air on their lawn?" My mother was so angry, she was panting. I cranked open my window. I leaned out. "Are you circus folk?" I yelled. So that feels very much like me.
And you're the kid saying, "What was I born into a circus or what?"
You know, my dad used to steal turf from other people's houses.
Oh.
So, you know, he would go to these new houses where they had laid out the turf and he would steal it and bring it home. So that's where that came from.
Akhil Sharma, it's a joy to see you again. I'm dying to get into these stories. But first, you sort of scooped yourself in The New Yorker online with this story about your own growing up. I mean, these stories all turn in some way on sex and what it's all about or isn't. And you write that you had an experience with a older woman when you were in your mid-teens. And it went on. But tell us about it. And also, of course, how it feeds your creative life today.
So when I was 15, I began sleeping with this woman who was 40 and married. Just a lady in the neighborhood. And what occurred for me, it's very damaging, you know. I was in a crazy family to begin with. I had an older brother who was severely brain damaged, and we were taking care of him. And, you know, I already had a sensibility that moved towards sadness.
Hmm.
And here is this person, the only person who touched me, who expressed affection for me. And, of course, you know, if you're 15 sleeping with a 40-year-old woman who's married, you're going to always think that happiness is elsewhere.
Hmm.
You know, and so it trains your mind in things that are not healthy for it. I also found that for me, it trained me in dishonesty because it trained me to believe that the secret life is more important than the life that exists in the sun. And in some ways, the secret life is more powerful than the life that exists in the sun because, of course, it's much more compressed. You know, it echoes, it's louder, but it's not more important. It's much less important. You know, when you move some of these secret things out into the sun, they evaporate.
Trained you in the double life from adolescence.
Yeah. I mean, there was a double life already because of other things, but yeah.
Meaning?
Well, I feel like I had the sense because of my brother that I wasn't a good person, right? Because I had survived and I was glad I was the one who survived. And so I always grew up with this sense that I had to hide myself, hide the fact that I wasn't a good person. And so there was always a sense that I was pretending to be like other people, whereas I was really not a good person. And so there was always a double life. And for me, the longing, you know, the longing of getting to the bottom is a longing to get to being a good person.
Good measured how?
Honest, kind, somebody who's able to love freely and deeply, somebody who's willing to put himself aside for other people.
Happily, does that mean?
You know, Dante said God's will is man's peace. You know, and so we put ourselves aside, not because we seek happiness in the moment, but because in the long term, it's better for us.
You know, I ask about how you measure the good life simply because in all of these stories, sexual element almost everywhere, there's a kind of non-morality, or at least hidden morality, or maybe different from ours. But the sex in these stories is not Freudianized or Christianized or moralized or medicalized. It's just sort of, it has a different framework around it. I want to get to that. But before we go there, though, so what happened to the 40-year-old woman? She turned 45 and 50. Then what happened?
The poor lunatic called me about a year and a half ago and told me that she had some terminal disease that she was going to die from. And, you know, as soon as I heard this, I thought she was lying, you know, just because she's crazy. And then a month later, she called me back and she said, no, it turns out there are no symptoms. Who knows? You know, who knows what the truth is? Who knows what she believes or doesn't believe? I just want to stay away from her. And that would be my preference.
But you also wrote that she turns up in your fiction. And you say, wow, of course that came out of that memory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she turns up in my fiction. She turns up in my earliest story, the story If You Sing Like That for Me, which is the only story told from the point of view of a woman. But she turns up in that some of her sensibility feeds into it. But what turns up is not her now. What turns up is the experience of her now.
So it's not that woman who turns up, but it's the you that turns up. Did she make you a writer?
No. She didn't make me a writer. I was a reader and writer long before I met her. She made certain things more powerful, right? And so she made the sense of loss sharper. She gave me certain narrative themes. But I don't think she made me a writer in any sense.
The amazing thing about these stories is that you've introduced us to a whole world of Indians somewhere back and forth between Jaipur and Greater New York or something. They're in business, they're related, they're connected by mango pickles and families and rituals and kinds of parties you have and kinds of parties you don't have and things you do and don't do. How do we begin to grab all of this? The sexual morality fascinates me. The joylessness, in a way, of the sex in and under the morality. But there's a whole cosmos here. We know how carefully, scrupulously you've observed it and written it and rewritten it. But I want to know more.
I mean, there's a lot of joy in the sex in Cosmopolitan. In that story.
Cosmopolitan, yeah. The story named for the magazine. The guy is reading Cosmopolitan to try to figure out what women want, what you should say to them at a party.
Right. So I think there's a lot of joy in that.
A lot of fun and humor, but joy? Physical joy?
I mean, he's kind of delighted by this woman's body. Even in A Life of Adventure and Delight, when his girlfriend, at the very beginning of their relationship, she feels very self-conscious.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, you know, she's very heavy. And he says, you know, you're so small, you get lost in the bed. There's a lovingness and a playfulness at that point. Obviously, there are difficulties for these characters. For me, in terms of the cosmos, I think my world is not known to my readers.
Speak about this story, which affected me tremendously You are happy. It's a line taken from the drunk mother in the story. It's her greeting at parties. This woman is in terrible danger. Mm-hmm. And the son watching it is tortured by what's going on. Sketch it, and then I'd love you to sort of explain.
So the story is about this young man recalling his mom. And it begins with him wanting his father to do something about her because she keeps behaving in ways that embarrass him. And so it begins with him wanting his father to beat her so that she will stop acting this way.
Stop drinking.
Stop drinking, stop embarrassing herself, stop embarrassing him and his family. And there's also a real sense of sexual danger. You know, there's sexual danger for women who get drunk in America, and there's a real sense of stigma about the same thing in India.
Yeah, drunkenness worse than promiscuity.
Drunkenness is much worse than promiscuity. And his father's family owned some farms in India. And there tend to always be farm girls in India who one can have sex with. You know, it's very sort of droit de seigneur sort of stuff. And his father falls in love with a woman, a young woman from there, and decides at that point that he can't take his wife anymore. He can't handle her craziness, her alcoholism. And so he decides to get rid of her. What typically occurs in these sort of situations is that the family of the woman does the crime, you know, commits the murder. So that's what the story is about.
And it happens.
Mm-hmm.
But the descriptions, the language is so precise and in the end heartbreaking. The boy goes back to India and he meets somebody in the mother's family who has an intuition.
That this is what occurred.
Yeah, that she's been done in. And the uncle says, they're scary people.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody owns 70 trucks without committing crimes.
Yeah. I mean, that's the truth. Nobody makes money in India without being a criminal, without having to deal with crime. I mean, what's interesting for me with the, in terms of the writing, in terms of the sentences, is that I tend to write very plainly. And periodically, language becomes very, very heightened. And those are only at liminal moments. You know, that's where life has gotten so extreme that language needs to hurry up to keep up with it. So, for example, when the child goes into the room where his mother is trying to drink herself to death, and there's all this light pouring in, and he says, oh, the light is like above the clouds. You know, it's inhuman, that light. Or when they're taking her to the detox, and the light reflected off the store windows that they're driving past feel like music. Or at the very end, when he can't sleep, and early in the morning, the birds start, and it feels like they're up and awake and wanting to share their dreams. It's at that point that some internal thing is occurring which can't be reflected in language, in ordinary language, and so language begins to warp in response to that need. Language needs to reach beneath reality, you know, touch all the emotions and bring them out. You know, sometimes we're affected by things even when we don't know how. You know, something occurs and we're rattled, and that rattling gets manifested in the language.
Your language in these stories, Akhil, if I may say, just stabs you, sometimes with something very funny, sometimes with something very dangerous. In that story of the drunken mother, the boy is watching and he says, Daddy won't like this.
Mm-hmm.
Let him die, she replied happily. Because she doesn't know that she's the one in danger.
Yeah. All these things, you know, you look at these sentences again, like on a second reading, and they have all these weird meanings.
So it dawns on the boy that his mother's been murdered by her family.
Mm-hmm.
And where is the boy forever after?
You know, he's at the farm and he says, oh, I can't ever come back here. I can't ever come back to this world where this has occurred. And I mean, for me, what's interesting is the story begins with him wanting his father to beat his mom. And then he realizes that this is the reality. You know, but this is common. You know, we have these dreams and our wishes, but we don't understand what these things mean.
Hmm.
Like, I remember when I was a child wanting to be the only son. You know, so I could get more attention.
You were the second.
Yeah, I was the second. And then my brother had his accident. And sort of, it's funny to realize you want certain things, and then what you want is not what you can handle. You didn't understand the consequences of your wishes. for me, emotionally, that was part of what was going on with that wish that the child had. There's that phrase, you know, you begin as you mean to go on. You never know what the consequences of your actions are. So you have to begin with virtue. You know, you have to begin in a good-hearted way.
Akhil, this story and others remind me, and I'm reminded that we spoke of Chekhov the last time.
Yeah.
But this story reminds me of In the Ravine, sort of peasant ignorant murder in a mill town. But this has the same precision and clarity in the descriptions, emotional and physical. I feel we're back in sort of Chekhov world.
You know, he is the gold standard of all short story writers. So we all aspire to do one or two of the many things that he did. I mean, I know I certainly feel that way. More than almost any other writer, he's the writer that I admire.
Stick with Chekhov. Do you know that story, In the Ravine? I'm sure
yeah,
you do.
Yeah, yeah.
Am I right to be, you know, even thinking about it?
I mean, that and Peasant Women are the two stories that leap to mind. In the Ravine is where the woman pours boiling water on the little kid and murders him. And Peasant Women is where these two women talk about how much they hate these men and why don't we murder them. To me, Peasant Women seems a little bit more reflective of what occurs in this story, because in Peasant Women, you begin thinking that these men are good people, and then you realize they're monsters. And it's something similar occurs here, where you begin by thinking, oh, the husband is stuck with this woman, and this woman is a problem. But then you realize that the woman is okay. You know, she's just sick in her way. These other people are the monsters. So for me, Peasant Women is a more exact parallel.
Who are the monsters, in case I miss them, in these stories?
You know, there's a monstrousness when you decide your needs or your desires are so important that you're willing to destroy somebody else. So certainly I think of the father as being monstrous in this particular story. I don't know if they're monsters, but their behavior is sometimes monstrous. It's so unkind and so unloving that it takes one's breath away. Like I feel in The Well, the behavior of the young man is so unkind that it takes one's breath away.
Remind us.
Well, what occurs in The Well is there's this young man who falls in love with this woman, and he's pretty certain that she doesn't care for him the same amount that he cares for her. And he tries to get her pregnant because he hopes that'll mean that she'll stay with him. And that's just so unkind. You know, that level of behavior is monstrous. I mean, I don't think of these people as monsters, but their behavior is monstrous.
Speak of the story that everybody does, in which a young NYU student is soliciting prostitutes online and then trying them out, but really bargaining with them. The bargaining is more important than the sex. What's going on there? And in general, I keep wondering, what's the system that you're constructing of judging what's right, what's wrong? There's a lack of conventional, shall we say, middle-class Christian American morality around a lot of these events. But there is another system, which I'm still trying to dope out of what the rules are, might be, should be.
You know, I grew up in a very pious family, right? My parents pray about five times every day, formally. So they'll get up and they'll pray first thing in the morning, then they'll pray after their bath, they'll pray in the afternoon, they'll pray in the evening, they'll pray at night. I don't view them as super virtuous in that they're not very honest people. But I pray every day myself. I don't believe in God, but I pray every day.
How does the conversation go?
I have a bunch of prayers that I use. You know, one of them is to ask for help to be honest, ask for help to not feel self-pity, ask to think of others. You know, whatever I feel like I need to be a better human being, I ask for. And then I pray for a lot of people, especially the people I dislike or I'm jealous of. And when I do, I mean, some of these people are just jerks. You know, they behave very badly towards me. And when I pray for them, I ask that they get the same things I would want for myself: good health, peace of mind, satisfaction with their life, that their loved ones are taken care of, that they have financial security. And so it feels very Christian in that there's a real sense of realizing that they too are children of God. To me, it feels very Christian. But to be Christian means accepting the fact that these things exist, that bad behavior exists. I think that middle-class Christian morality, unsophisticated Christian morality, doesn't recognize evil. thinks that, oh, there must have been a glitch in the system that these bad things occurred, versus the fact that these bad things are part of the system.
And while you're at it, where does sex come in? Sexual desire, sexual pleasure, sexual loyalty, sexual attachment.
You know, I think we're all animals. You know, there's such comfort in touching and being touched.
Mm.
Like, who would not want that? Right?
Conspecific touching. Touching in the same species.
Yes, exactly.
Earthworms same, love it.
Exactly.
Bluebirds love it. We all love it.
Yeah. And so that's part of intimacy in a relationship.
But does it have rules? Rules of kindness, rules of obligation, rules of equality?
It depends on what these two consenting adults want, right? Like if one adult says to the other one, hey, can I spank you? You know, and the other person says, sure, why not? If it gets you off, okay. Then why not? You know, at least in my experience, the only thing that really works exists within sort of this very strong sense of safety. Like I would get a little bit crazy if there wasn't safety. If I didn't think the other person was very honest, wasn't super nice, and not just nice to me, but nice in a more general way, that would make me feel very insecure. And then the physical intimacy would evaporate because I would think, what am I doing here?
How do they become dramatically powerful in your stories? I'm thinking of the one that ends with a young man who solicited a prostitute and she's jumping up and down in front of him, his hands on her breasts, and we're all having a wonderful time.
Mm-hmm. You know, he's obviously a troubled person. I mean, there's two things, actually. One is that the big problem there with this guy is that he's in a relationship. If he were not in this relationship and he wanted to do this thing, then why not? You know, go ahead, man, do whatever you want. One, he's in a relationship where he should not be doing these things. And two, he seems to have some really strange problems in terms of sex. Like what you mentioned about not being actually interested in sex with these prostitutes, but wanting to just negotiate price, you know, or that he calls this woman over and is thinking, oh, I can't do this, you know. And then when she arrives, he thinks, oh, she's so good looking, it's such a bargain, I might as well do this. So these are weird problems, and they're only tangentially tied to sex. Sex is sort of where they're getting manifested, but the problems are inside him.
Why am I somehow relieved that these problems, whatever they are, haven't been Freudianized? We're not talking about sort of recursive childhood fantasies or anything else. We're sort of there. Listening to you show us this new set of rules, or different set of rules.
To some extent, I don't really care about explanations. I don't care about the why of things. You know, I care about what are things like right now? And I care about how are these problems being addressed or failing to be addressed. That's what interests me.
I'm thinking of a monster mural with infinite detail, a Bruegel painting of kind of village life in Indian New York. What was going on in that scene in the early 21st century?
You know, I try to represent these characters based on what I know. You know, like I know that the first thing these Indian graduate students do as soon as they arrive in America is look for hookers. Very first thing they do.
Before they unpack the bags.
Basically. And so I just try to build based on my sense of what's going on.
Dare I ask, I mean, what is the truth that comes out of that story, for example?
I don't know if there's a truth. I think what there is a series of questions that are posed. I think the only truth is, oh, here's a human being struggling with various issues.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think there's more than that.
To me, the challenge and the fun, the joy of these stories is entering a world where, almost anthropologically speaking, the rules are different. And we don't come with all the old obvious rules about you don't form fantasy relations with TV characters or older women or whatever. But no. People do strange and marvelous things. Let's watch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, people are terrific, you know. People just do the most wonderful things. And, I mean, the other thing is that all of these characters can change. Like, even when you look at A Life of Adventure and Delight, there's no reason to not think that there is a process that is being worked out, you know, that he has this relationship. In some ways it's good, in some ways it's not good. But that doesn't mean that the next girlfriend won't work out better. You know, just because you make mistakes once and a second time or a third time, that doesn't mean the fifth time you will make the same mistake. You know, we learn, we change. You know, we learn to value certain things.
Okay, Sharma, imagine Anton Chekhov reviewing your book, picking it up and saying, young fella, I'd love to talk with you about it.
You know, I am older than Chekhov was when he died.
Wow. Right? 44.
Yeah. So Chekhov would probably not say young fellow, right? He would probably say, oh, you know, how nice that you can write these sweet little stories. I think that's probably the level of praise that he would offer.
Then you might say, you should be writing more of them. He wrote thousands.
Yep, he wrote a lot. But most of them are these tiny one-page things.
But then he looks over your stories and he says, you're aiming at something very grand here and great. And then what?
You know, when I've been praised by writers that I admire, I am not taken aback by the praise, right? Because I do think that what I do is meritorious. What I'm taken aback by is by the fact that my words have been inside these people's heads. You know, in the same way that these people's words have been inside my head. And so I suddenly feel, oh, I'm part of a tradition. That's what takes me aback. You know, when I receive praise from somebody I really respect a lot. We don't have to be as good as Chekhov to be worthwhile. Because Chekhov was good in many, many different ways. Whereas I'm only good in one or two ways. And so to receive his praise is nice.
What can he do that you don't do?
I think that the way he pushes the subject of the sentence way into the sentence, so two-thirds of the way into a sentence. And so there's much more of a sense of just pure voice existing, of things existing in darkness. Mm. Oftentimes you don't know what the pronoun is referring to. And so because of that, we keep getting popped out of the story and we exist on the surface of the story and so it shimmers. And that shimmering, the fact that we're getting popped out, oftentimes means that transitions exist in very funny ways. So he does not seek legibility in the same way that I do. And because he doesn't, he can move around much more freely than I can. I also certainly think he's a much funnier writer than I am.
You're a very funny writer.
I'm amusing, but he's really funny. I think that the quality of description that he has, the moral weight of description, like when he talks in Lady with a Little Dog about the waves beating and how they'll be beating long after these two people have gone. And in that permanence, in the beating and the endlessness of it, seems to be the only possibility of hope. There's a weight in his descriptions which I brush up against, you know, like when the young man comes into his mom's room where she's drinking herself to death and says, oh, the light feels inhuman. I brush up against it, but I can't do it as constantly as he can. I'm a good writer. He's a great writer. Mm. And it's not wrong to say, oh, other people are better.
Surely he would look at your work and say, we're in the same game.
I think he would have looked at what I wrote and said, I recognize what you're trying to do.
Which is?
Trying to tell the truth. I think he would have recognized that.
That's a lot.
It's something.
Akhil, such a joy to feel kind of an open channel to your amazing mind and your heart and your presence. And it doesn't happen every day.
Thank you.
Akhil Sharma's new story collection is called A Life of Adventure and Delight. You are invited to like the book and Open Source on Facebook and to leave a comment on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the Open Source Podcast Project.